What's up, y'all? It's Zach. We live in corporate. Look, I'm so appreciative of the content that we create day to day, week to week, month to month, year to year for the past 5+ years. You know, it's been a journey. And I just want to say thank you to everyone who's been rocking with us. If you didn't know, I'm going to tell you right now, we exist to center and amplify Black and Brown folks at work. And we do that by having really frank, authentic conversations. Think about like the conversations you have with a friend or a colleague or a mentor or aspiring mentor or mentee over drinks or coffee or whatever. It's when you're really having those real conversations about career and life and navigating the workplace. I was not privileged to have a ton of those conversations, but the five that I did really blessed me. Now I'm playing. I had more than five. I mean, come on, I've been working for a while. So I've had more than five. It feels like I've had like, I feel like I can count the really authentic conversations on one hand. And I just remember years ago thinking about what does it look like to bottle that up and make it accessible to thousands of people, because everyone isn't privileged to have someone that looks like you pull you aside over coffee or just on the side and give you the real talk. And that's what Living Corporate is all about. Yes, you're listening to the flagship show, but Living Corporate is a network of shows, and everything that we do is based around authentically centering and amplifying historically marginalized voices at work by investigating, interrogating the systems, and imagining a better, more equitable place to work. Yes, we fall into the diversity, equity, inclusion space, but we don't really use that language like that, because a lot of that has been co-opted, watered down, and centered around people that don't really need it. We're trying to have authentic conversations every single day that center and amplify the people that actually need to be centered and amplified, which are Black and Brown people, Black and Brown women, Black and Brown queer folks, Black and Brown trans folks, Black and Brown non-binary folks, Black and Brown disabled folks, Black and Brown first generation people, right? Black and Brown folks, period, right? That's what we're trying to do. And so thank you so much. I'm excited about the conversation you're about to listen to. We'll be right back. Harris, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you? Thank you for having me.
Look, it's a pleasure to have you. You know, I'm okay. You know, it's interesting. Of course, like I want to talk to you. I can't remember how we got connected, but I'm really excited about your book, Black Women, Ivory Tower, Revealing the Lies of White Supremacy in American Education. And I think beyond talking about your book, I'd like to talk to you about your work, right? Like, what for you inspired you to even talk and engage on the subject of and the realities and experiences of Black women in education? Like, where did that come from?
Personal experience, honestly. And that's the cool thing about sociology. My PhD is in sociology, is that it's about the world around us, right? And the way that people experience it and the way that particular societies are structured and the cultures that they develop and how that impacts people differently by race, by gender, by religious identity, all of those things. But I will say that when I was in graduate school, when I was in my doctoral program, and this was in the, you know, mid 2000s, I was actively sort of pushed away from studying experiences of people like myself. But simultaneously, as that was happening, I was also finally getting the language to understand my own experiences, right? And be able to start to analyze and explain the experiences of people who look like me, right? So my dissertation topic actually was on the career trajectories of Black women living and working in Minneapolis and St. Paul, which is where I'm from. And that was totally born out of watching my mother go through things and sort of wanting to be able to study it from this sort of scientific perspective. And so, you know, I got into a tenure track position, and, you know, much like when I was in school as a student, experienced racism and microaggressions and discrimination and all of that stuff. And, you know, like a lot of Black women like me, Black people, I just talked about it with my people, right? My parents, my sister, my family members. And it was actually my mother who said to me one day when I was complaining about the discrimination that I had experienced in the workplace, that I should write about it, right? And I should say that my mother is one of those Black women, she's a, you know, from the boomer generation, who just thinks that you should be able to do anything, right? So I'll have an idea and she's like, well, you should see if Oprah would like
mom,
that.
That's my
right?
mom
and
it's like, all day ma'am. Long. That's my mom all day long, 100%.
It just cracks me up because she just thinks, you know, it must be easy to get in front of these people.
Or so if it's not easy, you can do it.
I can do it, right? Because I've done all of these other things. I have a PhD. Like, why shouldn't I be able to make these sorts of connections? And so when she originally said, you know, I should write a book about this, I was like, okay, mom. Yeah, I'm gonna write a book about it. That sounds... And then I started to think about it a little more.
Yeah.
And I just got my notebook out and started sort of writing down things that I had experienced and sort of thinking through those experiences with the theory that I had been engaging with for other research. And it just clicked for me. And this was maybe in year two on the tenure track, that this was where I needed to be going, right? And not because other folks aren't doing it. There are, you know, lots of Black women in academia that are writing about our experiences in higher education and more broadly, you know, institutional racism in higher education and sort of what that means for Black students. But I thought that it was important to put my experiences down, to corroborate those experiences with the historical experiences of Black women in higher education over time, because as I was experiencing those things and when I didn't have the language for that, I internalized that stuff as me problems,
some
right?
personal shortcoming or failure or inadequacy, perhaps.
Exactly. I must have done something wrong. I misunderstood what the expectation was here. I wasn't good enough, you know, to get this grant or get into this school or whatever. And I wanted to be able to reassure Black girls and Black women that it's not about you, right? It is about the system. It's systemic. When we say that things are systemic, we mean that it's meant to feel personal, right? It's meant to feel individual as a way to mask the fact that this is actually a much bigger and broader problem.
Yeah.
So that, and that's why I wrote it in a very easy to read, you know, this isn't an academic sort of language type book. And I imagine it for 16, 17, 18 year old girls in high school and, you know, 20, 30, 40 year old women in college and graduate school working in higher education. We all have experienced these things. And I wanted to just say that, right? Without any shame and let people know that there's no shame in that.
You know, it's interesting. I was watching a video recently of a young woman. She was a college student. She was a track athlete. And she was running like the 400, and like the video was of this white man who like walked up on her and was like, yo, we gonna race, like I think I can beat you. And he and she like smoked him. I think she ran like a 58, right? Which is like, for people who know track, ain't he? Yeah, that's like crazy for like a regular civilian. She was like, yo, I'm just, right, kind of like warming up, like I'm jogging, I'm not actually even going as hard as I could, and I smoked you. And then we also then see, and I want to going somewhere with the fact that we're also seeing Bill Ackman, well-known mega donor, activist donor, billionaire entrepreneur, who like established himself as like an expert in academic plagiarism. I'm curious, like, do you see a through line of men, particularly white men, asserting themselves as experts in spaces with academics and expert and like with people who are actually trained and like who have studied for years in these spaces. Have you experienced that in your career? And what advice would you give to black women, to black and brown women more broadly, around how to even navigate like the audacity of that?
The audacity of whiteness, sure. Right? Which is something that we talk about a lot in my sort of space in sociology. And absolutely, right? I remember when I was in graduate school, I did my doctorate at the University of Minnesota. And I suppose I can tell this story because this faculty member is not there anymore. Okay. But I was in a graduate class, mm-hmm. and I wrote a paper that was born out of some very superficial, like trivial archival analysis that I had done in the library, looking at different ads in old Esquire magazines and old, was it Self? I can't remember what the women's version of that was that I was looking at. I wrote this paper, I turned it in, and the professor, white man, asked me to stay after a few weeks later after he had handed everyone's papers back. Again, this is the mid-2000s, so we're handing things in and getting them back. He asked me to stay after, and he accused me of fabricating the work, essentially. His argument was that it was too good. Essentially, the paper was too good. The analysis was too well done. How could I have possibly completed this work? And I was flabbergasted. And honestly, that is a paper that I still have not published. And every year I say to myself, I'm going to go back to it. I'm going to, you know, try to get it out there for publication. Yeah. But there are all these like negative feelings around it because this person just could not believe that a young black woman, I was probably 25, 26 at the time, could have done this work, mind you, in a doctoral program, in one of the top sociology programs in the country, right? So it shouldn't have been in a cohort of 12. I think we started out with 12, right? So they picked 12 people in the country to be in this program and then expected that the one black woman in the cohort would not do well, right? And my doctoral experience, and there are some faculty who were great, and I love them and they know who they are. And the rest, you know, were very much in a lot of ways waiting for me to fail, right? I started in a cohort of 12 in 2008, and there was one black woman and one black man, everyone else was white, and the black man left after the first year, which I think was the expectation, and I ended up being the first person to defend my dissertation in the cohort, which is not what they were expecting, right? And so that experience, again, is just so common for us in, not just in higher education, but to your point about the example of the track runner and the white man who challenged her, it happens across settings for black women because there is this perpetual dehumanization. That's the through line, right? Between the black woman being challenged on in a 400. And as someone who ran track in high school and never ran the 400, one time my coach made me run the 400 because the girl who was supposed to run got sick. I was a 200 runner mostly. Mm. And I cried afterwards. It was so hard. It's the hardest event, running event in track, in my opinion, sprinting event. And so for a white man to walk up on a woman who was clearly training, right, and suggest that he can beat her just because of who he is, right, that audacity of whiteness, that audacity only exists if you don't think of the people that you're challenging as human, right? And Bill Ackerman is such an interesting example of this. And I laughed when you called him like a so-called expert in plagiarism, because that's coming back to bite him, right? So he did all of this work to get Claudine Gay out as Harvard University's first Black woman president, and the shortest tenure, only 6 months. Because of what it turns out were just citation errors. And you're talking about a dissertation that was written in 1997, when most articles, academic articles that would be cited in a dissertation were not digitized, right? And there's that, right? And then the second piece of this is that citation practices in higher education vary. Like, that's the nice way to say it.
So that's the part I want to, I mean, first of all, I very much want to get into Dr. Gay. But like, to acknowledge your point around people questioning, like, could you have possibly done this? So it's interesting, right? Because I'm not a Black woman, I'm a Black man, but I can certainly still empathize with that and relate to that from a racial context, perhaps not on a gender context. Several times in my like grade school career, I was accused of, hey, who helped you write this essay or whatever?
Who helped you?
I never forget, like, literally what was eerie about what you said unlocked a memory for me. My senior year in high school, I wrote this paper about the cyclical nature of history. That's all. Like, it was like, hey, write a paper about anything. And I'm going to be honest with you, Dr. Harris, like, I did not take school serious. So I was not even really being serious when I wrote the essay. I was like, let me just write about how history repeats itself. And like, that's really it. You know what I'm saying? Like, we're going to, and like, not only does history repeat itself, but like, part of that history that repeats itself is people unwilling to learn from said history, which is why it continues to repeat itself. Like, that was really like the core of my paper. And I gave it to my teacher who had a PhD in education or in maybe even in sociology. I don't know. And he was like, this essay reminds me of other essays I've seen over the past several years. And I believe that you lifted a lot of these ideas. Mm. And my mom got involved because my mom is in education. And then my English teacher got involved and he apologized. And then he graded my paper and it was an A. But I think, like, going back to what you said about like citation and rules vary. I have a perspective. I'm curious to hear your reaction to it. Is when people started pulling out all these errors around Dr. Gay's work, my position was, and still frankly is, whatever those errors are, I don't care, because whatever she decided to do was, again, from my outside estimation, like, very much so likely in line with whatever else them people was doing over there. So I'm not saying she copy and pasted nothing. What I am saying is, if she copy and pasted something, it's probably in line with the cultural context of that working environment, right? Mm-hmm. I think so that is my position, but my challenge to that is, do you think that Black folks in general, and we can double click on Black women if we want to, this is not blaming people, our tagline is real talk in the corporate world, Dr. Harris. So we don't have a real conversation. You know what I'm saying? All right.
Okay.
So I think sometimes Black folks, Black and brown folks, historically marginalized folks, we get lulled into a false sense of security, thinking that we can do the same things that our white / majority counterparts do. And I'm curious, I'm curious to get your reaction to that, like, around this whole citation thing and whatever. Like, do you think that that's something that we have to be mindful of? And if so, what does it look like for us? What does mindfulness really look like?
It's a really good point, right? And I totally agree with you. And oftentimes, especially at the higher levels, I think we're sort of seeing this with like Clarence Thomas right now as well, right? With this idea that, well, this is what folks in this field are doing. And so I'm sort of following suit. I'm, you know, a part of this culture without remembering, right, that as Black people, we are going to be the ones who are ostracized, regardless of what that culture expects or accepts, because we don't actually belong there, right? So we're not going to be given that same benefit of the doubt. The problem with that is it's this sort of double-edged sword, right? Where when you are in the moment, in the culture, the expectation is that you are working as a part of that culture, right? So if Dr. Gay or anybody, for example, were to come and say, listen, y'all, these little citation practices y'all got us doing is going to get one of us caught up. I'm going to be a bit more particular in my dissertation, in my articles, and quote everything rather than trying to paraphrase and decide where my thought ends and somebody else's thought begins. Because then we get labeled as uppity, right? Now we're uppity. Now we're too good for, you know, the culture. It's very no win for Black people in a lot of ways. Because had Dr. Gay made a fuss about these things back in the 2000s, she would have never been the president now, right? Because she would have ostracized herself in that particular network that leads her down the path to the Harvard presidency. And I think, you know, the perfect example of this is what's going on with the other college presidents who also testified at that hearing that they supported free speech on their campuses, right? In the line of questioning about how the presidents were handling anti-Semitism. That's how this all gets started. And they all, because of their comments there, open themselves up to additional sort of scrutiny. President McGill, who was the president at University of Pennsylvania, she resigned as well a few weeks before Dr. Gay did. But she was able to do that of her own volition. There were no deep dives into her citation practices. There were no accusations of affirmative action policies.
Insinuations on her character.
The reason for, exactly. There weren't questions about her belongingness in higher education. It was simply, you can't say that in this political environment right now when you're leading this school, and as the board, you know, we're going to have to ask you to step down. Dr. Gay, because she was Black, right, and a Black woman more specifically, then is not only being criticized because of her comments about, you know, free speech and anti-Semitism, but now she is free game to criticize all those little pieces of the work that she has done over the last 30, 40 years that people have been waiting for, right? And I think that that's the difference between being Black or brown in these very historically white serving spaces and being white is that you can go with the flow if you want to for now, right? And in a lot of ways, you don't always have a choice in that. But as soon as there is an opportunity to get you out of there, right? One misstep
we'll pull that.
Is going, exactly. Whether you know, engaged with the culture or not.
Yeah, I genuinely think it's like really depressing, right? And I want to talk a little bit more though about like, just even like the function of like operating as a Black woman in these spaces. And so there's a lot of parallels I actually see between Dr. Gay's experience at Harvard and frankly, like the chasing of the wind that is a lot of times pursuing executive level C-suite positions in corporate America. Right. Yeah. I'm curious if you like have seen any of those, any lines of thought and critique around Dr. Gay. And like, this is also, obviously you are not Dr. Gay. So we're not about to,
right.
Okay.
Right.
So I'm using that as a really more as a point of reference to like talk more broadly about like the space, but there's a lot of commentary around Dr. Gay being part of like this, this overseer class that, that really was there to like reinforce, the same principles and practices of Harvard. They mentioned, they talked, you know, in relation to like Palestinian students who were doxxed, as well as the black RA who was kicked out of his, was evicted out of his dorm, and like no advocacy for that. And in addition, like her opinion piece, which still didn't mention any of those thousands of Palestinians that would have been killed in Gaza. Part of me, when I think about that, I question, like, do we broadly as black folks, and then I'd love to hear your perspective on black women more specifically, do we have an honest, is it a fair critique? And then two, like, is it reasonable to expect for black folks in higher academia, when they reach those really prestigious levels, to be an advocate in a way that is counter to the culture of the institutions they serve?
One, I think that the critiques of Dr. Gay are warranted, right? But there is no way to reach those levels that we're talking about, to become Harvard's president, without reifying the same institutional racism, discrimination, structures, cultures that exist. I mean, honestly, even being a professor, you know, this is something that I have had to come to terms with, that I know that a lot of other faculty talk about often. I am, you know, especially now, because I work in Texas, I work for a public state university, University of Texas at San Antonio. And in a lot of ways, that makes me an agent of the state, right? I am the program coordinator for African American Studies at UTSA, but our legislation just passed all of this anti-DEI stuff that has resulted in the closing of our DEI office on campus, that has made my program and myself a target in a lot of ways. And the institution is trying to figure out how to handle that. But I'm still going to work every day, right? I'm still, you know, doing the service of the state for these students, and albeit certainly not at the Harvard level, right? But there are ways that we, as, you know, professors, faculty, administrators, who are also people of color in higher education, you know, there may be ways for us to push against some of that existing institutional racism. And, you know, I think of my book as one piece of that. Mm-hmm. But I had to do a lot of work that wasn't that in order to get tenure, right? And so it makes me think about, this conversation makes me think about Du Bois, right? And I love Du Bois, and over the last maybe 5 or 6 years, I've become much more interested in his life and his life's work. Because, you know, he is one of the sort of founding fathers of the sociology discipline, although the discipline is just now sort of acknowledging that work. Mm-hmm. But Du Bois was also, you know, he was a Claudine Gay-esque figure. He went to Harvard, right? At a time when Black people were not being admitted to Harvard like that, right? And he was able to go to Harvard because he had white network connections that advocated for him to get into that school. There's always discussion about the relationship between Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, and, you know, the way that they sort of thought about how to uplift Black communities, you know, post-Reconstruction in the United States, where, you know, Booker T. is very focused on vocation, you know, Tuskegee is about teaching particular skill sets, and his thought process is about trying not to agitate the white upper ruling classes, right? By trying to engage in the same systems that they work in. Whereas Du Bois is like, no, we got to be there, right? But not all of us, right? That sort of talented 10th idea is very much in line with what we see today in terms of the Black people that are in, you know, C-suite executive level positions, presidents at universities, right? That there is a measure of acquiescing to those systems and structures that you have to do in order to be a part of those systems. And that changes the way that you think, right? I mean, a story that I love to tell my students is about the marriage of Du Bois's daughter, Yvette, to County Cullen, who was known to be a gay man, you know, in Harlem. He was best friends with Langston Hughes and others. And she was essentially forced to marry County because the man that she was in love with, a dark-skinned jazz musician, was not deemed by Du Bois to be a suitable spouse for her. And their wedding was, you know, the wedding, the event of the year in Harlem that year. And while it's going on, everybody is whispering, you know, about, you know, the fact that these two people don't love each other. What, you know, what are we doing here?
Right.
And my students are always shocked to hear that story. They're like, oh, Du Bois? Like, and I'm like, yeah, he, you know, had some issues with colorism. He had some issues with classism that come when you move yourself up, you know, into white upper class spaces.
Right.
And you start to, you know, buy into those things. And so I think that Dr. Gay's, her comments, her work, her lack of voice around certain things is certainly critical, but not unexpected, right? When you think about Black folks in those spaces.
So essentially, and I want to make sure I understand, like you're saying, like sociologically, like there's a, and maybe even there's a historicity of classism, elitism, I'm not gonna embarrass myself trying to find another word. Within the black space, and perhaps the W.B. Du Bois is like one of the, like the godfathers of like the Black bourgeoisie elite class, right? Am I
right?
Okay, cool.
Right.
And then like also, yeah. Also wasn't W. He was also hating on what's her name? On he was a sexist too. Like he was trying to squash what's her name?
Oh yeah. He was. Are you talking about Zora?
Zora and. Man, Zora and, well, yeah, first of all, yes, Zora, like not to skip over that. Yes. Mm-hmm. But he blocked Black women's voices from being published and you know, and like even being accepted in a higher ed, you know, so it's interesting. Like I think what was interesting about that time, like post Reconstruction was, I think like there was actually like an upper middle and like poverty class. Right. Mm-hmm. So like that's not justifying anything, but it's curious now because I believe that like Black upper class or Black elites today, because economically everything is so, and I'm not an economist, but I'm just talking about just as like layperson, like everything is so meshed together.
It's so constricted
yeah. Mm-hmm. That really like the modern Black bourgeoisie elitist boule, whatever, their primary motion in talking about how they are upper class is to point to how they're not this other group of Black people, right? I mean, yeah, I struggle with it, Dr. Harris. I mean, so there's parts of me where I'm like, okay, like I don't want to see Black people mistreated at all, like off top. So like I'm never going to necessarily mm-hmm. cheer for that. At the same time, I struggle when I see people who are like in a certain class and or who are obviously differentiating themselves or purposely separating themselves from other Black folks in the service of white institutions or in the service of white power.
Right.
Like, and I said this, like, well, no, I didn't say this part because it's too much nuance to put on social media. People think you hate Black women. It's like, no, I'm just saying, like. Like, what happened to Dr. Gay was wrong. We can also honor mm-hmm. and respect that, like, there are plenty of Black and brown students at Harvard that she did Absolutely. Not serve as she Yes. could have, right? And so, you know, Mm-hmm. but I appreciate your answer. I think, like, the logical follow-up I have to that is, if it is not really practical or honestly possible for historically for people from historically marginalized groups to ascend in white institutions without adopting the same behaviors and motions of said white institutions, what is your perspective on, like, a whole or majority migration of Black academics to HBCUs?
I think that would take a lot of money. You know, that's really the problem. I went to Vassar as an undergrad. So, you know, sort of in that same, like, upper class sort of thing, I went to school with, like, Samuel Jackson's daughter.
Oh, you was Jack and Jill?
Yeah, I personally was not Jack and Jill, and I did not even know what Jack and Jill was until I got to college, yeah. and I met all of these Black Jack and Jill kids, and I was like, nobody told me that this was going on, right? Yeah. You know, speaking of, you know, this sort of space between upper class, and, you know, I was more like middle upper class growing up. So it wasn't exactly Jack and Jill, but I think that's only because my parents hadn't heard of it. And if someone had told them, we probably would have been right there, with those folks. But there is this, how do I want to put this? You can't move beyond the class system that you have access to, right? And that plays out very specifically in higher education in terms of how those schools are funded. And I use the word funded very particularly because I'm not just talking about federal or state funds, but the way that alumni and family members fund schools, right? So Vassar has like a $3 billion endowment that continues to grow in part because Sam Jackson donated a lot of money when Zoe was there. Tom Hanks's daughter, Liz, was also in my class. He was donating a lot of money. Meryl Streep's daughter is 2 years behind me. And then her youngest daughter, the one that's in the Gilded Age now, she also graduated from Vassar like 5 years after that. Wow. So, and Meryl herself is an alumni of Vassar. So she has donated probably tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars Sure. to that school in the last 30 years or so, right? And so when Black faculty, and actually the sociology department at Vassar just hired a new Black man as assistant professor, which I was excited to see because there were no Black men faculty in the sociology department ever, as far as I know. He may be the first one that's tenure track, that's because that school can afford to pay him to go there, right? I went to Vassar because I got a huge academic scholarship to go there. At the time, it was like $45,000 a year. And my students were like, what does it cost now? So we looked it up. It was like $85,000 last year, which is insane. I know. But my academic scholarship was like $30,000 a year. Wow. My parents paid like $5,000 a year, and then I took like $10,000 a year out in loans. So I didn't have much student loans coming out of undergrad relative to the cost of the school. I wanted to go to Spelman. I got into Spelman. I didn't get any money to go to Spelman. And my parents were like, we cannot afford to send you there. My sister is the same. She went to University of Dayton in Ohio. She wanted to go to Hampton. She didn't get any money to go to Hampton, right? And that's not the fault of those schools. It's the fault of the way that those schools have been funded, both internally and externally, over the last 100 years, right? And so I would love to be a faculty member at an HBCU, but those jobs one, you know, are few and far between, because often when Black faculty get those jobs, they never leave them, because those are the ones, you know, that they want to be in. Those are the communities that they want to be in. And two, if those jobs do come about, they often are paying $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 less a year to the faculty than, you know, a school like Vassar, for example. And so you've got this two-pronged issue where the Black students who want to go there can't afford to go there because the schools can't afford to support them going there. And so they end up at PWIs. And the Black faculty who want to teach there can't afford to teach there because, you know, we know what's going on with the economy right now, and that's only getting worse. And so they end up at PWIs. And so instead, what you have are a few Black students and a few Black faculty sprinkled across PWIs across the United States, and most not being able to participate and engage in the HBC community the way that they would want to, right? And so it's like a pipe dream. You know, when folks say, And this would happen to me as well, and I'm probably expecting this backlash when the book comes out next week, but folks are like, well, if you had such a terrible time at the PWI, why didn't you just go to an HBCU? And it's like, again, it's systemic, right? It is not, I didn't want to be at a school with Black people. I wanted to be at a school with white people, and so I deserve the things that happened to me there. It was the way that the system is set up. This was my best option, right? I mean, and if we think about Claudine Gay as well, I mean, I don't know her sort of personal history, but I do know that she is a Harvard undergrad alum as well, right? And as a Black girl in the late 80s, early 90s, getting accepted and financially supported to attend Harvard is not an opportunity that you can pass up, right? And that's why we're fighting about all of these schools in the first place, because those schools have the networks, they have the money to attract and bring in those Black students, right? But when we get there, there is an expectation that we assimilate, that we, you know, acculturate into their system. And some people are able to keep those pieces of themselves separate, right? And sort of engage in performance. And I actually talk about this a lot in the book, the sort of exhaustive nature of having to do that performance and then being able to go home with your family and be a little bit more normal. Yeah. But you sort of have to do that unless you are willing and able to do the alternative, which is, you know, be in that HBCU environment. It just, and we've lost so many HBCUs, right? And so many HBCUs have lost accreditation. I know a few years ago, Morris Brown was asking alumni with PhDs to teach courses for free on a volunteer basis. Yeah.
And I know they just got their accreditation back. Like, that was a huge,
they just got it back.
That was a huge deal. I mean, so let me ask you this, and then I want to respect your time. I feel like we could, because there's a part of me.
We could do this all day.
I was like, pardon me, but yeah. I feel like another hour. But I'm going to respect your time. So,
okay.
You know, I'm curious, being that you're a trained sociologist, and you mentioned in your book the exhaustion, exasperation of acculturation, pressures of acculturation and assimilation into these white, majority white spaces. Or even just Eurocentric spaces, whatever. I'm curious, as you look at like the future of like Black and brown people, sociologically, like, do you think that like young millennials and Gen Zers have the wherewithal, stamina, willingness, interest to really do that over time? Because like, I don't. Like I say that as a 34-year-old. I say that as a 34-year-old who was working at PricewaterhouseCoopers, Accenture, Capgemini, And was pissed off at how I was being treated, built my own company while I was still working crazy hours, and then built that up to the point where I could just leave and do this full time, which is now living corporate.
Right.
But I also say it as a big brother to a bunch of Gen Zers. And I say that as a father to two toddlers who I can already tell are not going to.
They're not going to take anybody's. They're not going to do that shit at all,
Dr. Hill. I'm telling you, they're not. So, but that's me, though. Like, I'd love to hear your expert perspective on it. I feel as if we're going to get to some point where we're coming to a breaking point. And that's not to diminish the impact or the power of your book at all. It's more about, mm-hmm. I'm asking, like, do we really see this system that we're talking about existing and sustaining over the next 40, 50 years?
I hear what you're saying. And my students say this kind of stuff to me, you know, all the time. Like, what is the point? You know, why are we sort of continuing to engage in this society that clearly doesn't want us to succeed, be successful, and all of that? And it's interesting because one thing that I used to always say to my students before I wrote this book was, I don't have answers. I'm here with the data and I'm going to give you, you know, the theory and the data and the statistics, and then you do with it what you will. And as I was writing the book, I started to have those same questions. Like, what the hell am I doing? You know, like, I'm crying as I'm writing this stuff. Like, this is bad. You know, like, maybe I have, you know, really mess my life up, you know, mess myself up internally by trying to participate in and be accepted into these systems. And the final chapter of the book is actually called Benediction. And it's really all about like hope and faith. And I realized that if I didn't have faith that there was some way forward, a better way forward for Black people in higher education specifically, but, you know, in American society more broadly, sure. I couldn't go on, right? I couldn't continue to show up in class every day and teach students and ask them, you know, to do assignments and do homework and to engage in critical thought, you know, in the way that we do in my classes. And that faith is connected to a hope that these generations coming behind us are stronger, angrier, you know, more willing to tear things down than we have been. And, you know, I'm a millennial, I'm 40. And admittedly, and I say this to folks all the time, we're not the fighting generation. Like that was not what we did. We were told this is how you become a successful professional adult. You do that, you focus on that, right? Mm-hmm. And that is what we did. I mean, I even remember I started my freshman year of college was 9/11, literally, like, you know, 2 weeks into my freshman year of college, 9/11 happens. And there are no protests on my campus. You know, there were no, there was no ensuing anger about the sort of political and military response of, you know, the United States. And I do remember seeing people protesting, you know, in the streets in New York and Chicago and so, but that wasn't happening on college campuses, especially not college campuses of like a bunch of upper class, wealthy, mostly white folks, right, like at a school like Vassar, right? And so what the folks in my generation did was we just took it. And we took the trauma, we took the violence, we let it happen to us with the expectation that if we made it far enough, then we would be accepted, right? And that's what makes me not necessarily like side, quote unquote, with Dr. Gay, but to understand what has happened to her, and even in her op-ed, you know, her unwillingness to talk about the experiences of the Black and Brown folks on her campus, because she's still grappling with the fact that this happened to her, right? Because in her mind, she's like, I did everything that Harvard, that upper class America, that white America asked me to do to be able to belong in settings like this. And I still got treated like any other Black person.
I mean,
and it, how do I deal with that? Right?
She needs to listen to that Jay-Z song.
Yeah.
Black.
Yes.
Still.
Yes. Still Black. Still listen. OJ needs to,
yes,
as well.
I'm
right?
Not Black, I'm OJ.
There are a couple.
Okay.
Right. Well, even, I mean, we saw Tiger Woods recently talk about this stuff, right? Who was famously, like,
I'm
call me Caucasian or whatever it is. And at the time, we were just like, well, that's kind of weird, but I guess,
okay,
you know, we're just let him do what he wants to do.
He's
right?
Really good at golf,
in,
so
in hindsight,
it's weird.
Exactly. So we'll just let it go. Right. But in hindsight, it's like, we should have called that stupid 30 years ago, right? And we just let it go because we were all being socialized in this sort of Cosby Show, Huxtable-esque. And as someone who, you know, was an ardent watcher of the Cosby Show, I used to have all the, I still have them, I just haven't opened them in years, but all the seasons on DVD, right? We, Black people in particular, especially middle class, upper class Black people, through the mid 80s, 90s, and early 2000s, were socialized to believe that if you, it's that respectability politics stuff, right? If you just got the right education, talked right, dressed right, raised your children right, then you could be upper middle class, you could own a brownstone in New York City, you could have your own doctoral practice, right? You could, you know, be a partner at a law firm and white people would accept you, and, you know, you'd never have to experience any of the racism of the past. And I think what the Gen Z and Gen A generations are recognizing is all that was bullshit. Sorry, I don't know if we're allowed to swear.
I said nigga, so yeah,
but,
you go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah.
I try to be careful about my language. But that's not reality, right?
Yeah.
And that they look at us and say, y'all were duped. You know, they told you to do that and you just did it. And now look at you. You're not any, you know, better off than any of the rest of us. And so my hope, right, is that as long as I continue to put that information out there, as long as I continue to teach, you know, what institutional racism is, what systemic racism is, that these coming generations with more access to information, with more access to history, right? Well, you know, Republicans are trying to prevent that, but
in theory,
it's hard to do, right? You know, with all of the ways that you can access information these days, that they will be the ones to say, this doesn't work. And if one generation can pull down a couple of bricks and the next generation can pull down a couple of bricks, and at least we're heading in the direction of destroying these practices, right? And if I don't have that hope and if I don't have that faith, then why am I going to class? You know, why am I teaching? Why am I in this profession? Why am I writing these books? So,
Dr. Harris, this has been a phenomenal conversation. Thank you so much for coming. The name of the book is Black Women, Ivory Tower, Revealing the Lies of White Supremacy in American Education. Again, the author's name is Dr. Jasmine L. Harris. Dr. Harris, we can see you're a friend of the show. Can't wait. Keep in touch. Make sure to have you back.
Yes.
And we will talk soon.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me. This is great.
And we're back. Yo, thank you so much for listening to Living Corporate. You know where we at. We're everywhere you listen to podcasts. You know what I'm saying? We're literally everywhere you listen to podcasts. If you want to learn more about Living Corporate, living-corporate, please say the dash.com or just Google Living Corporate. You know what I'm saying? At this point, SEO is pretty popping. You type in Living Corporate, we're going to pop up somewhere. okay? Make sure you check us out. Links in the show notes. You learn more about us, learn what we're trying to do. Make sure you actually create a profile on living-corporate.com, okay? Make a profile on there so you can actually stay in tune and up to date with what we got going on. You make a profile, you select content that you're really interested in, and then we'll push content to you from our library so you can actually have a curated experience every time you go and log into Living Corporate. Ain't that dope? Okay? Think about that. We got over 1,000 podcasts and different digital media and content that we've made over the years, and it's going to be all pushed and curated for you, baby. For you, dog. For you. All right? Till next time. I love you. Take care of yourself. Peace.
Living Corporate is a podcast by Living Corporate LLC. Our logo was designed by David Dawkins. Our theme music was produced by Ken Brown. Additional music production by Antoine Franklin for Musical Elevation. Post-production is handled by Jeremy Jackson. Got a topic suggestion? Email us at livingcorporatepodcast@gmail.com. You can find us online on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and living-corporate.com. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned.